Good evening and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Mark Zitter, CEO of Zitter Health Insights, a healthcare market research firm, and a member of the club's Health and Medicine member-led forum. I'm also chair of today's program. Today's program is all about breast cancer, which, of course, is among America's most feared diseases and also one of its most politicized. Most people know someone who has been touched with and perhaps died from breast cancer, and pretty much everyone knows someone who has had to make a decision about being screened for breast cancer. Yet the available information to help make these decisions is changing, it's conflicting, and it's emotionally and politically fraught. Tonight's guest is Dr. Laura Esserman, a surgeon and breast cancer oncology specialist and director of the UCSF Carol Frank Buck Breast Cancer Center, a renowned researcher who focuses on helping patients use information to make better decisions. Dr. Esserman is recipient of the National Cancer Institute's SPOR Investigator of the Year Award and a member of President Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology Working Group on Advancing Innovation in Drug Development and Evaluation. Dr. Esserman is nationally and internationally known as a leader in the field of breast cancer and has published over 150 articles in peer-reviewed journals. Her research and writing focus on the goal of giving patients better access to accurate information so they can become partners in their healthcare. Given the complex and changing data regarding breast cancer and the seriousness and prevalence of the disease, it's hard to make decisions on what to do. I brought with me today's issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, one of the top journals in the world, and there's four or five letters at the end, research letters, of various breast cancer experts, researchers, statisticians, arguing about exactly what the data say. And if in the top journal in the world, the top experts are arguing about it, it's hard to make these decisions. So you're going to, I hope that by the end of tonight's program, you'll have a better sense of why it's hard, but also perhaps how to make some of those decisions. Because few people in America have the combination of scientific background and daily clinical experience that Dr. Esserman has, as well as the passion to help patients make decisions that are right for them. You may have read about her in the article in the New York Times that talks about how she sings to her patients before surgery. She even takes requests. I don't know if we're getting any requests tonight, but we will get Dr. Esserman, so please help me give a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Dr. Laura Esserman.
Thanks so much for that very generous introduction. I really wanted to touch on something, in a really important theme tonight, and that is one about when less is more. This is something I think is not well understood, and specifically when less medicine is actually better medicine. This is going to become an important topic that is going to be discussed widely in the next couple of years, and I think it's important for everyone to have a grounding in it. I'm going to use breast cancer as an example, of course, because that is the area that I practice every day and I know best. But there is so much of medicine to which this applies, and there is a decision in your life and your friend's life, your parents' life, your children's life, all of which revolves around this critically important issue. Why is this so challenging? It's challenging because in my profession, there is an inclination to always believe that more will yield better results. But it's also motivated by fear, afraid of not doing enough, afraid that if there is a recurrence or a bad outcome, that you will be blamed and you didn't do enough. And from the patient's perspective or the person who has an illness, when trying to make choices, often there's the question, have I done enough? Or I'll leave no stone unturned. I want to do the most I can do. But that's not always the wisest thing to do. And I think it's important that fear not be the driver. At a time when you're very frightened and you have a diagnosis of cancer, that is when your judgment can sometimes be the most impaired. and you're the most afraid not to choose doing enough. So what happens? We often say, well, we did everything we could, and so everyone feels okay about it. But is it true? Have we done everything we can? Have we really thought about all the information that we can? And can we make the best decision? And it isn't that there's a right or wrong, as you just heard. There are many people arguing about the pros and cons of many of these things. And often the key need is to be able to lay out what the options are and to see how they work for you. You know, one of the things that I think it's important to understand, because there is a lot of talk about screening and overdiagnosis, and I want to talk a little bit about where that comes from. Sometimes not only is more not better, because more is just more, it's not better, but sometimes more is worse. What do I mean by that? So let's just say a 42-year-old woman goes forward, has her first mammogram, they find a calcification, they think, oh, it's probably not going to be anything, they do a biopsy, and they find in situ, carcinoma in situ. So what does that mean? Well, we used to think that this was something that if you didn't do anything, it would necessarily go forward and progress to invasive cancer always. But it turns out that's not true. And if this woman winds up, not uncommonly, someone might wind up getting a bilateral mastectomy. If that was never going to turn into something, have we done that person a favor? That's the topic that we're going to talk about tonight. So it takes courage and wisdom to do less. The stakes seem so high. But some of our most significant advances in medicine have come from understanding what's working, and once we know what's working, how to ratchet things down. So, for example, women used to be treated with a Halsted radical mastectomy. That meant taking all the skin, the breast, the lymph nodes. These were unbelievably deforming procedures. That seems like such a terrible procedure. And people did not know what their diagnosis was before they went to the operating room. This is really how cancer was treated when I started my training just a few years ago. And we've come such a long way from that. But you have to remember that was something great that was offered in the early part of the century when women who got breast cancer were left in a room to die. So it was a big innovation for the time, and it also reflected what we did for women who had very serious and very aggressive cancers. Let's move the clock forward a bit and say, now what's happened? What's happened is that we now screen for breast cancer. We've now learned that doing less surgery is just as good as doing more surgery, and everyone is happy about that. Taking out fewer lymph nodes is better than taking out more lymph nodes. No one's unhappy about that, as long as you can do it safely. These are not things to be afraid of. In Hodgkin's disease, it used to be a fatal disease. When I was training, we did staging laparotomies. That means we took out the spleen, we did bone marrow biopsies, we did took out all kinds of lymph nodes. People got radiation across their chest, and this actually cured people. So this was a great advance. But then we started saying, well, now if we can cure 95% of people, now we have to start thinking, are there side effects? That radiation, especially to young women, increased their chance of getting breast cancer by 30-fold. So we no longer do mantle radiation. We no longer take people's spleens out because there's a chance that they can die of sepsis because they really can't protect against certain kind of bacterial infections. So this is part of learning. Part of learning and improving in medicine is learning what to do and what not to do. as a surgeon, as someone who's an interventionalist, the wisest surgeons are those who've learned what not to do. And the wisdom of medicine is learning to know it's not that you can't do everything. We have the capability of doing every intervention. So many things we can do in medicine. But what is real wisdom is the ability to try and do less. So I think it's really important that not only physicians, but patients be in that position where they say, I want to demand and demand an explanation. So when someone says to you, I want to do something, or recommend makes a recommendation to you, here are your choices, what you would want to say is, okay, what are my alternatives? And always a good thing to compare to is doing nothing. Because sometimes you'd be surprised what doing no intervention is. At the end of life, it turns out that palliative care isn't doing less. It's actually the better option, especially in lung cancer. These are notions that people need to think about. So there is also an important movement coming forward about personalized medicine. And this is the idea that one size doesn't fit all. And why is that? We now know that breast cancer isn't one disease. It's actually many diseases. Some are very slow growing. Some are very fast growing. And we wouldn't treat, you know, we would treat two women who come in with very different cancers. We'd never treat them the same if one had a slow-growing cancer that was hormone-positive and another had a HER2-positive one that has a special marker where we have very specialized treatments. We'd never treat them the same. That's progress. That's great. And going forward, one of the things that's happened as we've started screening for breast cancer, as we've started screening for prostate cancer, as we've started screening for cervical cancer, we have the capacity not only to find and prevent cancers that might otherwise kill you, but also to find a reservoir of indolent disease that actually would never come to attention. So how did we get into this position? So back in the 70s and the early 80s, we looked and said, well, look, who is dying of cancer? People with late-stage disease are dying of cancer. And people with early-stage disease are doing much better. Stands to reason, right? The best thing to do is just to find it early. Screening saves lives. Early detection saves lives. How many people have heard that? How many people have that running through their head? That is the notion. Well, it turns out it's just a little bit more complicated than that. It can save lives. But we have to understand that when you screen, you are necessarily going to surface disease, a lot of disease that is more indolent. So where is this common, more common knowledge? We really understand that. So prostate cancer. How many people have heard the story that we're doing overdiagnosis in prostate cancer? Okay, so almost everybody knows that. But it actually turns out that any disease for which you screen, you've got the same problem. Overtreatment can be prevented if you can understand and recognize at the time of diagnosis that you have a more indolent cancer. It's very interesting. In my field, in the breast cancer field, there have been many multi-gene tests that have arisen now to help us understand what is lower risk and what is higher risk, and to help try and target treatments accordingly. So here's another very important concept that I think is often difficult and challenging for people, physicians included. There's the notion of risk, and then there's the notion of what it is you should do about it. So it turns out that chemotherapy, for example, is a very targeted intervention. It's targeted because if you have a fast-growing tumor, it's likely to be very effective. If you have a relatively slow-growing tumor, it's not likely to be anywhere near as effective. And there are many tests now, there are a couple of tests now that really help us understand even the setting of node-positive disease. There's a big study in Europe that's going to be reported in a couple of weeks. If you have slower growing biology, even if it's node positive, is chemotherapy going to benefit you? Now, this doesn't mean you don't have any risk. It means that particular treatments aren't necessarily going to help you. So this gets into this business of, should I do everything? You know, I'm going to do everything. I'm going to fight it. Well, of course you want to fight it, but you want to do those things that will actually help you the most, That, I think, is a critical notion. And that's the kind of data that you should be asking for when you're having a conversation with your physicians. When we said that, what is the prime driver of sometimes doing more than you need? And it's fear. And the thing about cancer is, with the exception of maybe some rare leukemias, cancer is not an emergency. Cancer is an emergency because you know about it. You always have time to understand your diagnosis and ask for the options. So it turns out that if all these cancers are different and the treatments are different, maybe it doesn't make any sense to screen for cancer as if it's all one disease, right? That's just common sense. So it cannot be that one screening regimen is the right regimen. Now, I have been pretty vocal about saying it's time for a change in screening. I get a lot of hate mail. I particularly get a lot of hate mail saying, I'm willing to let these young women die of cancer because I don't care. I don't think anyone could accuse me of not caring about my patients or not caring about this issue. I have devoted my life to it. In my other hat, when I'm not trying to think about how to change screening, I run a national trial called the I-SPY trial, where we're really trying to accelerate the pace of getting new and effective agents to market, but getting them to the right patients and to do it much faster and to bring those in earlier at a time when they can make the most difference. So it's not that I don't care. But it turns out that over-treating a bunch of people who have slow-growing disease does not help the person who has the aggressive disease. Right? So that is important. And there are no guarantees. You know, bad things can happen. And it doesn't mean, and sometimes those things are just not in your control. What you really want to do is make the best decision you can with your understanding about the biology. But for hormonally driven tumors that grow more slowly, hormonal therapies can be better. If you knew you were at high risk for a hormone-positive breast cancer, the obvious choice would be prevention and trying to think about what you can do to prevent that. So one of the things that we've really talked about or tried to think about is, how can we change the way we screen? So it turns out the breast cancer screening actually uses a lot of resources. It's not a very expensive test for one person, but in aggregate, it actually uses a lot of resources. Does anybody have any idea how much screening in aggregate for the United States might cost?
$40 billion.
Do I hear another guess?
$1 billion.
Anybody else? There's lots of people here. How many people think it's less than $1 billion? How many people think it's between $1 and $2 billion? How many people think it's $5 billion? How many people think it's more than $5 billion? Okay, well, you know, so that's not fair. So it actually probably, if we were to screen 85% of the intended target population, screening the way what is considered to be the Cadillac of screening, it would cost about $10 to $12 billion, maybe more. That seems like a lot. But so it's not, is that too much? Is it too little? Well, it turns out if you screen more like what the U.S. Preventive Task Force guidelines suggested, would be more in the range of $4 billion. As we wrote a paper about this, and the person writing the editorial commented that that difference was the annual budget of the NCI for all cancer research. So that just gives you a sense of perspective. So I would say that for that kind of resource, shouldn't we have some feedback on performance? Shouldn't we know how well it's working? And, you know, all this argument, how many people have read about the mammography controversy in the papers? Okay, just about everybody. Does anybody know how old that data is that we're arguing about? 40 years old. It's all 40 years old. 40 years ago, we didn't even know what an estrogen receptor was. We didn't know about HER2. We didn't have modern cancer treatments. We didn't know anything about risk. We didn't even know about BRCA1 and BRCA2. We didn't know now that there are 9 inherited genes that could put you at risk, high risk for inheriting, for developing a breast cancer. So it seemed to me that what's necessary is for us to put together a modern era trial to try and get to a better answer. So one of the things we've put together, we have a network across the five University of California campuses called the Athena Breast Health Network. We're all working together, and we started this trial called the Wisdom Study. It's called Women Informed to Screen Depending on Measures of Risk. And this trial is testing what people think is the Cadillac of screening, annual screening, for everybody starting at age 40, using age as your best risk factor, compared to a personalized approach. And that personalized approach says we're going to look at all your genetic risk. We pick nine genes that we think are worth. So it's a population-based testing to find out whether you inherit any of those nine genes, plus the small variation in genetic makeup that you have. Each by themselves, not very important, but all put together, when you look at them together, they actually make a big difference, and they can actually be a big contributor to risk. And one of the reasons we're trying to do this is we first want to say is for the people who have the highest risk, and there's not that many of them, let's make sure we're doing the most for those people. And for the people at the lowest risk, maybe we can do a lot less. All those biopsies and recalls and mammograms, maybe there's a group of people who don't need to be screened so often. I don't hear anyone complaining about not having a colonoscopy every year. Most people are very happy to hear, oh, we moved the guidelines from 2 years to 5 years to 10 years. I didn't see anything in the front paper of the paper of anyone complaining about that, right? So this is so doing less is not necessarily bad, right? This could be a good thing. So what we're trying to do is say, what are your exposures? What is your family history? What is your genetic makeup in a modern setting? And then say, what's the right age to start? What's the right age to stop? If you have multiple medical conditions, it doesn't make sense to be screening for breast cancer. You have to be, have a good chance of living at least 10 years. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to be screening. And if you have low risk, surely, as you get older, there should be some advantages, like not having to get a pap smear, not having to get a mammogram. And those things are true, but people are afraid not to have that. But what is the consequence? The consequence is being called back, getting biopsies, being told you have DCIS that maybe you don't ever need to know about. So this is what this whole trial is about. And we're actually going to try and recruit 100,000 women. We actually just did our pilot study. So everyone can participate in the study. We say that most women have spent 30 to 40 years screening. We're asking them to spend 5 years participating in this trial. It's going to open in the Bay Area this summer. And one of the things that we're trying to do, we were funded by the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, PCORI, which, by the way, is funded by the Affordable Care Act, which I think is actually, it's a great thing that they're really trying to invest in understanding some of the most difficult problems in medicine and really putting some effort to trying to get answers. And very interestingly, they're quite pragmatic, and they said, look, they want you to have something that can be ready to be put into practice. And so what does that mean? Often we do trials and no one pays any attention to it. Maybe there's lots of reasons. People, they can't believe that something isn't worth still doing, and they still want to do it. Or maybe it's kind of people don't want to change their practice, or maybe it's they like the way they practice and don't want to change. There's lots of that. Or it's hard to get the payers on board. So over time, the payers would actually, this personalized approach would actually be much more cost-effective for payers. But they, of course, can't lead the charge on this. But also, if you think about all those resources that are being invested in screening, surely we should be investing some of those resources to help us shift and move. It shouldn't all be from grants. We should take the money we're already spending. And if we can make it the same cost as what we were doing and provide the fuel to learn and change, surely everyone should have skin in the game. So our requirement is that the payers step up to the plate and do coverage with evidence development. I'm happy to report Blue Shield is the first to step up. University of California, their self-insured plan, they're stepping up. Salesforce is going to do it. We're actually, our intent is to get all of the payers on board by the end of the year. And I think it will be, I think that's a very important model. These are big problems. Everyone has to have skin in the game. Everyone has to look at these models, and we and have to agree, okay, if the data changes, we're all going to shift. The thing I like about this trial, however, it's not a model where, okay, it's today's risk model, because I certainly hope that we have more things to test in 5 years. It's whatever your best risk model is at the time that we're going to continue to learn and adapt. And I hope this trial goes on to become a model for a registry that allows continuous learning so that we don't have to say, like we are today, that we're arguing over data that's 40 years old and hoping that sometime in, you know, 20 years, we'll have another big argument about how to change. So part of this is trying to learn how to learn. So I'm going to stop, but I want to just say you're going to hear a lot more about healthcare value. You're going to hear about, there was an article in the New York Times yesterday saying that many specialties, many, the Board of Internal Medicine and many specialty societies are going to start to say, okay, most of their 45 tests that we're doing routinely that really are not of value. And again, the reason for this is it's not benign just to do a test, because tests also have abnormalities. And the more you do, the more you're going to find. And the more you find, you can find yourself down the road. So don't be afraid of hearing that maybe you don't need a test. Welcome that and try and take the time to understand why. You'll be a better health consumer. Your care will be better. I think people, honestly, want a conversation. I think rather than doing a bunch of tests, we need people who are going to talk to their patients and have conversations about how to help them to a path of wellness. So I'm going to stop there and let the questions guide our conversation.
It's time for me to remind you that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Mark Zitter, CEO of Zitter Health Insights, and our guest is Dr. Laura Esserman, surgeon and breast cancer oncology specialist and director of the UCSF Carol Frank Buck Breast Cancer Center. I see we've got cards that are being passed up. I have a few. Please feel free to write down some more of your questions, but meanwhile, I'm going to ask you a couple. It just seems so intuitive that, at least on the testing side, if we test, we get more information. So people want more tests, right? Screening, whatever it might be. And if you could spell a little bit more on the specifics of what's the harm in getting breast cancer tests?
So I actually think that the biggest harm, so I sit on the other side where someone who gets an abnormality, how many, you know, if you are screened for 10 years annually, 50% of women will be called back. Okay, that's a lot of women being called back, and probably a quarter of them will wind up getting a biopsy. And at that moment, people will think, oh my God, I've got cancer. Now, if you have a biopsy and it comes back cancer, let's say that cancer really is what I would call a shoplifter cancer. And a shoplifter cancer. Well, you know, you have serious cancers and you have shoplifter cancer. So we actually have now developed a test to be able to identify what an indolent cancer is. So what does that mean? So again, if a cancer, so let's simplistically, cancers can grow very fast. And these cancers actually often arise between screens. So they're the most aggressive cancers. And screening's unfortunately not going to be the trick that gets us to cure those cancers. Getting better systemic therapy, trying to figure out what's causing it, those are the ways we're going to fix those cancers. The slower, medium-growing cancers, screening probably will help some, but our treatment's probably even more. Two-thirds of that benefit's going to come from that. Now we've got these very slow-growing cancers that are percolating along that maybe over someone's lifetime would never cause a problem, wouldn't maybe not come to clinical attention, or wouldn't kill them. Or at the very worst, can be treated simply with an excision, no radiation, no mastectomy, a couple of years of tamoxifen or one of the hormone medicines. That's not what people think about when they hear the word cancer. When you hear the word cancer, you think it's something that's going to kill you, right? It strikes fear into your heart, right? They're, oh my God, this is... And so you've got all that anxiety. You're worried about your kids. You're worried about your friends. We should not be using the term cancer for things that aren't going to kill you. You know, it's interesting. This is sort of what happened with the screening test, a PSA. How many people got PSAs that were elevated and got prostatectomies? There are some real side effects to that, right? You can be incontinent. You can have erectile dysfunction. There's all kinds of things that are totally disruptive to people's day-to-day lives. Now, a few brave people started just watching and waiting for these low early-stage cancers, Gleason 3+3. Last year, the report came out, 10-year survival, no treatment, 97% survival. Is that a cancer for which someone should go through a big operation with a 2 or 3% mortality rate or all those side effects? You got to know, well, what are you looking for? What kind? And now, interestingly, since that came out, about 42% of people are choosing active surveillance. Big deal. If you tell someone they have DCIS, people say, why not? I have advocated for taking the word cancer out of the term carcinoma in situ. And the reason I say take the term out of it is because DCIS by itself is not going to kill you. And it makes people frightened, makes them want to do things that, you know, I get emails all the time from people, or I have patients I take care of. I took care of a young woman who had a lot of family history. She didn't have a gene mutation. However, she had DCIS. The minute that happened, she's like, oh, gosh, I want a bilateral mastectomy. For her, that was the right thing to do. We talked about it a lot. She was sure about it. It was the right thing. But for someone else, you know, who was told, oh, my gosh, if you don't do this, you're going to die and you have to have your breasts off. And then she learns later that that's not true. And we don't know. We have no business telling somebody that they're going to die of cancer if they have DCIS because we don't know the answer to that. And in fact, it's incredibly unlikely. So you shouldn't use a term like cancer if it's not going to kill you. One more analogy, cervical cancer screening. Again, these are the screening world that was ahead of us. So we used to call the lesions that we found on cervical cancer screening cervical carcinoma in situ. But then it turned out they weren't as bad as people thought. And it led to a lot of aggressive procedures, which could affect people's fertility and their ability to carry a child to term. A big deal for women. So they didn't want to do that. They now call it CIN. Now for the CI, cervical intraepithelial neoplasia. But CIN kind of sounds like CNN. Relatively benign. So if you think about that, so it turns out Australia taking the lead on this, if you leave those lesions alone, more than 50% of them are gone in a year. You have to be clear when you don't know. We created an epidemic of DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, of the breast, through screening. And most of those are never going to go anywhere. So it is very scary, if you're at the beginning of that, not to do things. But the consequences are big. And so we have to have trials. We have to have people demanding better. Say, look, I want better treatments. I want better information. You know, everyone should say, that's why I'm saying, look, personalized screening, that is the way, the change in our ability to understand your genetics, why is that change? A change because the Supreme Court ruled that Myriad couldn't patent the genome. And it changed because the Affordable Care Act said that everyone could have insurance and they couldn't be discriminated on because of genetic information. So that means that we can know about these new genes. And we're partnering with a company for this trial called Color Genomics that the price is so low we can make it affordable to actually screen the entire population. It's very exciting. This is great. If you went to a store to buy a computer and you saw the model that was 30 years old, would you buy it? No. So demand the iPhone 8. That's what I say. You know, demand better.
This all reminds me of the joke they make about when people are getting trained in medical school, that the professor says to the student, "What's the definition of a healthy patient?" And the student says, "One who has not been sufficiently worked up." Meaning, if you do enough tests, you'll find something wrong with the person's body, even if it's clinically insignificant. But we've got a lot of great questions here, and several of them have to do with, I guess I'd say, the politics around all this screening piece. You know, you, I think, alluded to this, that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recently reiterated some recommendations it made in 2009, and to cut the chase about screening mammography, that basically, if I'm not mistaken, basically women in their 40s or in their early 40s, they didn't even say they shouldn't have be screened. They said they should talk to their doctor about it because the evidence is equivocal. So this is about as lukewarm a recommendation as one could get, right? But within 48 hours, if I'm not mistaken, both the government through Medicare and the major private insurers all disavowed it, said we're going to ignore that and we're going to continue to pay for everybody no matter what and so forth. It's really striking, and a couple of the questions are about that, and specifically about some of the advocacy groups who they say, you know, screening is their bread and butter. How are they dealing with the kinds of things you're talking about, saying let's hold off on screening if it's not warranted, or let's personalize it more?
So I think that, you know, again, people don't like change. And people sort of say, oh, they're trying to do less. They're trying to take things away from us. But I think I've tried to point out that, again, some things you want taken away. You know, it's not that they're being taken away because we know that they're better. There actually is a better way forward. And I'm not advocating to get rid of screening. But I think we need to be honest. The first thing we have to be honest about, how many people think that if you have a mammogram and a cancer is found, that mammogram for sure will have saved your life? Okay, so none of you. Why not?
Could be a cancer you would have lived your life and died with.
That's right. So it turns out that no one has ever said that screening is 100% effective, right? So this is the problem with medicine. You know, we tend to say, screening saves lives. You know, that we're, because it's a public health message and it fits on the side of a mammography van or a bus or whatever it is. But it turns out that the screening trial showed that there was a relative reduction, maybe 20 to 30% in the risk of dying of a cancer. So if your risk of dying is 10%, that benefit is 2 to 3%. If your risk of dying is 40%, even still, it's still about in the 5 to 6% range. So we make people feel terrible, make them feel guilty. Oh, my God, I have a cancer now. If I had only gotten a mammogram, it would have saved my life. None of those things are true. We have to be more honest about what we know and what we don't know. And I'll tell you, the path to doing better starts with recognizing that we have a place to improve. You can't make things better, first of all, if you don't have good outcomes and you're not measuring what you're doing. Anyone in business knows that. And, you know, you have to admit, like, I would say in breast cancer, we're doing our best to try and change the treatments. But when we offer chemotherapy, it's not like I can say, oh, if you have chemotherapy, 100% sure you're going to be cured. And I can't say that 100% sure you're not going to have side effects, because 100% sure you will have side effects. That's something that we do know. So everything is a trade-off that makes things challenging. Now, if you have an aggressive cancer, choices are easier because you have the treatments are worth the side effects because the benefit's higher. The choices are actually very difficult when you have an early-stage cancer that's no negative, that's not because small benefit, but a significant hit in terms of risks. You have to think about it. What is your own background? What is your own, you know, context of health? These things matter. That's what you have to bring to the table. And you have to make a good decision. You have to have someone who will sit down with you and talk to you about it. Now, getting back to your question about the politics, I say I'm not trying to eliminate it. I'm saying it's high time we made it better. And in fact, in this trial, we've brought everyone to the table. We brought the advocates to the table, brought the American Cancer Society to the table. I brought the screening guidelines people to the table. I brought the imaging people to the table. I mean, they say, well, you know, it's not safe not to screen women in their 40s. But I have the internal medicine people and the saying it's not effective to screen people in their 40s. I said, well, if we can't decide, then let's put it to the test. People, we ask people to be randomized, meaning let us assign you whether you're in the personalized or the annual arm. Then we have a better chance of learning, and at the end, you can change. But if you feel strongly about it, still participate in the trial and choose your arm. That, to me, is the right way to go forward. We'll get an answer. And everyone's sitting around the table. Everyone's going to look at the data. It's going to be public. That's the right model to move forward when we have uncertainty.
That's great. And actually, a few people asked how they could volunteer to be in a study like that.
Go to thewisdomstudy.org. Look for us on Facebook and on Twitter. And we're happy. We're actually going to be opening up the trial in August. And in fact, you can sign up and put your email in, and we'll contact you.
Great. You got some very tactical questions, too, like at what age does a woman no longer need to think about getting a mammogram?
So that's a great question. Actually, there isn't really good data that screening after the age of 70 is effective. So you'd say, well, why is that? So remember how I said that, you know, that, and this is, again, people in their 40s and people really later in life. These are where we have a lot of controversy. Young women are the most likely to get aggressive cancers. So the chance that screening is going to make the difference for them is not as high. And they're more likely to develop interval cancers, meaning cancers that come between screens. And they're also the most likely to get called back because they have denser breasts, more chance of calcification, so side effects are a little higher, benefits not as high. On the other hand, if you knew someone was really at higher risk, you'd want to do more for them and look harder. At the other end of the spectrum, as you get older, the kind of cancer you're more likely to get, and of course at any age people can get any kind of cancer, that's why you always want to look and you always want to tailor to biology, patient preference, and clinical performance. That's the what you always want to do. But older women tend to get much less aggressive cancers. So these more indolent cancers, the reason you don't have to look for them is the treatment would be the same if you found them early by screening or a little bit later if they came for clinical attention, and the treatment would be essentially the same. So if that's true, then the benefits are less. So one of the things that we're testing in the trial is we're looking at people's overall health, trying to put it in context, and again, based on their risk, only persisting with people who have elevated risk, and otherwise, you know, watching and looking to see what that difference is. So we're going to try and get an answer to that.
Great. Yeah, but a lot of people who don't even want to get to this point, they want to say, how can I prevent getting cancer? And there's questions generally about that. There's something specifically about diet, about vitamins and so forth. What can people do to not get cancer?
So there's lots of things that you can do to reduce your risk of getting cancer. But I will say cancer is an equal opportunity offender and can happen to anyone, and it's not people's fault. So anyone can get cancer. The things that you can do is obviously exercise is clearly associated with lower risk of cancer. Eating a diet that's rich in fruit and vegetables is associated with lower risk of cancer. Making sure that your vitamin D levels are normal is also associated with lower risk of. That's why I always say your sun isn't necessarily all bad. So make sure that you make sure that your exposure to vitamin D is sufficient. And I think there are other things. If you happen to be at risk for hormone receptor-positive breast cancer, there is level one evidence that you can prevent it. You can reduce that risk by about 50%. So that's not for everyone, because all these medicines that we use, that the same kind of hormone, the endocrine risk-reducing therapies that we use for treatment of cancer, can also reduce your risk. But for example, if you're like in your 60s and you have family history and you're at risk for ER-positive breast cancer and you also have low bone density, a medicine like Avista or raloxifene is a great choice because it increases your bone density and reduces your breast cancer risk in half. These are choices that you can make. It's like thinking about a statin. That is actually another part of the wisdom studies. We're also trying to be very tailored about prevention. and try and identify the people at the highest risk for breast cancer. And one of the cool things about the small variations in genetics, and even some of the inherited mutations, which are less common, is it's helping us to start to understand who's at risk for what kind of breast cancer. Remember I said all these treatments are different. People have heard about triple-negative breast cancer or HER2 breast cancer or hormone-positive breast cancer. What are the things we want to learn? We're going to profile all the people who get cancer on the Wisdom Study so we get to learn who's at risk for what kind of cancer and for us to really start putting in targeted prevention. And there's actually a lot of interest in the tumor immune microenvironment and sort of what you eat causing a change in your immune signals that you have locally. There can be maybe some very interesting new opportunities to think about breast cancer prevention by trying to set up these studies to look at the populations at highest risk.
Great. There are a couple questions about specific types of treatments, both radiation therapy and hormone therapy, and what's the latest thinking about those at this point?
Well, I think actually one of the most exciting things about radiation therapy is that this is an area where we can absolutely start to tailor and do a whole lot less for some people. So about 50% of people who get breast cancer have hormone-positive tumors that are relatively low risk in women who are postmenopausal. In those cases, it's pretty clear that radiation doesn't make a difference in whether you live or die from breast cancer. And for the most part, it's your local recurrence can be managed with the hormone treatments that you would be assigned anyway. And especially in these sort of ultra low risk or indolent, meaning not very aggressive cancers, there's no reason to think that you would need to add radiation. Again, I think this is one of those things that the dictum was mastectomy or lumpectomy and radiation. And in fact, that's still the way we are monitored. If someone has lumpectomy and you're not doing radiation, you know, the American College of Surgeons survey says, oh, you're dinged for poor quality if you're not adding radiation. But it turns out that there are lots of women who are eligible for either intraoperative radiation, which doesn't carry the same side effects as whole breast radiation, and there's an opportunity to do less. Just the idea of having to drive back and forth every day. Some people live hours away or would have a mastectomy because they thought they had to have radiation. How exciting to know that we can do less safely. And part of the way I think about what is an indolent cancer, that means it's slow growing. If it comes back, you have plenty of time to treat it, so you don't have to be so aggressive at the outset, and you can still do whatever you need to do should you have that low chance that it comes back. That's a very different circumstance than a very serious cancer that if it comes back, it's metastatic disease, and now you've got something that's not curable. That's a completely different story. So I think we need to do a better job of understanding that there are these differences. And I think we need to come up with better terms. I think cancer in 2016 needs a different set of terms so that we don't associate those terrible outcomes, because that's so frightening. Who could wait? Well, I don't want to sit here and wait for the other shoe to drop, right? But we don't want you to have to wait for the other shoe to drop. We want you to feel comfortable that less is, in fact, better. So that's, I think, exciting. The other thing about radiation is we are able to do more targeted radiation and shorter courses of radiation. So I think that that's very exciting. What was the other?
Hormone therapy.
So there is, I think, for the lowest risk tumors, probably you can do a shorter course of endocrine therapy. There is, I think, a really important study for young women with high-risk cancers that actually shutting down the ovaries and having the more aggressive hormonal approach is not just a little better, it's a lot better, and that makes a big difference. I think one of our biggest challenges is that we have data that says that 5 years is good, but 10 years is better, and even 15 years is better. But for whom is it better? It's only a little bit. And for people who are taking these medicines for a long time, I mean, some people can take them, no side effects, but there are some people who really suffer, and it really changes their quality of life. We must do a better job of figuring out for whom those medicines work. Maybe you could take them for 6 months, not take them for 2 years, take them for 6 months. We have to start thinking about that. But in order to make those kinds of changes, we have to drive to find early endpoints. This is a common thing. We have to not settle and say, oh, well, we can't learn. We have to learn in 20-year increments. I'd like to make more progress before I die, so I'm not willing to learn in 20-year increments. So we have to do better, and that's I think, important. I think for hormone-positive breast cancer, there's another set of agents called their cell cycle checkpoint inhibitors. So these are drugs that really interfere with our ability, you know, that hormone-positive breast cancers, I think, aren't that, you know, especially if they're not growing very fast, it's not that they're not, don't have any risk, because they can, their big problem is that they have risk for a much longer period of time. But the issue is, what do you do to reduce that risk? So hormone therapy is one thing, but now these new CDK inhibitors, there's three of them in trials, and that's, I think, very exciting. I'm really excited to see that there's some new drugs coming into the market for this class of drugs, but we need to figure out how to use them better, and we need to figure out how to have these early endpoints to change therapy faster. I'm a big fan of treating everybody up front. Cell cycle checkpoint. They're basically the cell cycle checkpoint inhibitor. So the idea is that, to me, the way to figure it out is, instead of operating, I'm a surgeon, I can tell you that operating first doesn't save the patient. If you're either not at risk for dying of your disease and surgery is sufficient, or if you are at risk for dying of your disease, the surgery is not sufficient. So you have to have a way to figure out whether it works or not. So that means you should give the treatment first and see how, and learn over the course of a window of time, might be 3 months, might be 6 months, how those medicines work. That's how we're going to learn in, you know, 1 and 2 year increments instead of 10 and 20 year.
There are a couple of questions, I guess I'd say, about the epidemiology of breast cancer. The question is, which ethnic groups are more likely to get breast cancer, and do we know why? And then, even though I think that the incidence in men is, what, only about 1 out of 1,000, is there anything we know about why some men get breast cancer?
Those are all good questions. I'll start backwards. So men, about 1 in 100. It's actually very uncommon in men, but it does happen. We do know that people who have inherited predisposition, like if you're a BRCA carrier, BRCA1 gene carrier, that your risk is actually, instead of being, you know, less than 1%, it's as high as 6 to 10%. So it's still pretty low, but still, you know, it's right, quite a bit higher than the average person. You know, different groups are at risk for different kinds of cancers. We know that African American and especially African women are at risk for hormone negative and very aggressive, a much more aggressive type of cancer. We don't understand. Actually, people are really looking at viruses. People are looking at the microbiome, looking at, you know, you're covered with, you know, tens of thousands of species of bacteria. So one of the questions people are asking now, could those species of bacteria have something to do with what your risk is, because it has to do with what your immune systems, how your immune systems work. So people are trying to think about that. We do know that that well-educated women in more affluent communities are more at risk for hormone-positive breast cancer, and that probably has something to do with reproductive cycles. So one other risk factor I didn't talk about was alcohol. We, sadly, two drinks a day are good for men, but not for women. So we say, you know, try and keep it to 3 to 5 glasses of wine a week. That's sort of when, in the epidemiology, you see an inflection point and the risk goes up.
But not all the same day.
Well, if you want to have 2 or 3 glasses of wine, make that the only day you drink that week. And otherwise, get a wine glass with some soda water in it and a lime, and it looks like a drink. So there you go.
Here's a question that actually was at odds with my understanding, so maybe you can clear it up. My understanding was that cancer death rates have been dropping. This question says, why has the number of deaths from breast cancer remained constant and not declined? What is going on there?
So actually, the death rates from breast cancer have been dropping, but we haven't seen as much of a, and that's probably, I would say two-thirds of that is probably from our treatments and maybe a third from screening. It's not entirely clear. In African-American women, we haven't seen the decline in death rates that we would like. I think as we get better at treating hormone-negative breast cancers, that those rates will start to go down. There are we are actually looking, this large trial that we've been involved in running, you know, that's just one of the examples of the big trials that are going around and going on in the world, and we're really trying to understand more about the biology of the disease and trying to understand how we can interfere with it. One, the non-hormone-driven cancers are often fueled by problems in DNA repair. This is basically like your proofreaders are asleep at the switch, and some errors happen. And why does that happen? And then once you get a cancer, that there's fewer and fewer proofreaders that are, you know, that are put to sleep. So there's that. And then there's also the business of somehow tumors shutting off your immune system and evading immune surveillance. Those are the two emerging ideas of some of these more aggressive cancers that we're now trying to change. You've heard a lot about immunotherapy. These now have been shown to work in melanoma, have been shown to work in lung cancer, so it's kind of an exciting time. We hope that it will work in these more aggressive breast cancers. We're testing these agents in the I-SPY trial and many other trials around the world. Also, the DNA repair, there's a class of drugs that really targets DNA repair. So if you have an inherited mutation, and like a BRCA mutation, you already have a defect in DNA repair. So if you actually put a drug that inhibits your ability to correct that, you get the cell just can't recover if you, and it can die. So if you don't have an inherited mutation, you can actually give a DNA damaging agent. So even low doses of some of the chemotherapy drugs can cause DNA repair. And if you then combine that with a drug that then says, okay, I can't possibly recover from this DNA repair hit, the cell will die. These drugs are called PARP inhibitors. You don't need to know what the rest of it stands for. But in general, that's these. So we're starting to see now more mechanistically based treatments that really are going after the fundamental biology of the disease. So if you start to have a better idea of what's driving these cancers, and then you've got this big trial like the WISDOM study trying to understand who's at risk for what kind of disease, I think that puts us finally in a place where we can start to say, okay, now I can maybe be thinking a little bit better about prevention and causality and trying to put those pieces together. So that, I hope, will bring us a much brighter future. Great. And by the way, now people will also say, how are we going to afford all these new medicines? These medicines are so expensive. And I would say that one of the things we want to fix is the fact that medicine and healthcare is the single largest cause of personal bankruptcy in this country. So as I said, more is always more. It's not necessarily better, and it can have devastating effects. So if we stop doing all these things that aren't making a difference, like these 9 tests that the internal medicine societies are saying stop doing, there will be plenty of money for the new medicines and the things that are targeted. So I think we have to be thinking differently about healthcare. We don't want to do the things that don't benefit you. Don't be asking for things that you don't need. Don't ask for antibiotics if you don't need them. Don't ask for extra tests if you don't need them. Right, and if you have questions, there's places you can go to look it up. But try and find a physician that will have that kind of conversation with you, because we want the future to be better. We want there to be better healthcare value, better outcomes for the same or fewer resources, and that resources don't just mean resources; it means also side effects. And I'll tell you, as I see the future of breast cancer, we are identifying, if we can identify non-chemotherapy type approaches for HER2-positive breast cancers or triple-negative breast cancers, and half of those people can be treated without chemotherapy, how fantastic is that? Then we can take the 50% of people who aren't responding and then start ratcheting up the more toxic treatments. That's the future. That's the future. Let's try and get these things cured with less toxic treatments that are more targeted and more tailored. That's and that also means sometimes you have to be willing to participate in trials that would allow you to get access to these newer therapies. We cannot learn if we don't all participate and figure out how to participate in trials. So everyone should, if something ever happens, and say, look, is there any clinical study that's testing the standard plus better? That's actually how we learn. And so, and we're working on trying to make trials more appealing and better and very patient-centered. But the community has to demand answers, demand better, and not just doing the same old thing, and not just doing more because somehow you're afraid to do less. Demand better information.
We're down to our last question.
Okay.
It's a two-parter. It is, why do you sing to your patients, and what is your favorite song to sing to them?
I sing to my patients because, you know, cancer is such a scary, it's a scary thing. And, you know, we who live in the operating room and are very comfortable, that's our normal workplace. We don't think anything about being in there. But if it's your first time there, it's kind of a creepy place. You know, and you're kind of, if you lay down and you look up at this ugly ceiling and all this equipment, it doesn't bother us, but it feels very scary. So if you, I love to sing. So and if you hold someone's hand and you have them look at you, not at the ugly ceiling, and not at all the equipment around them, and you sing them, I particularly love singing songs to people that they request, that's something very special and meaningful to them, because it makes them forget a little bit for a moment why they're there, and they feel held and taken care of and listened to. And it makes, you know, we as physicians would love to have the power to make everyone's outcome better and to change biology. We do not always get that opportunity. We do our best, but we don't get that opportunity. But everyone has the chance to help shepherd someone through a very difficult time and make that experience much better and make them feel cared for, listened to, and held. So to me, that's really what that's all about. Again, I like singing what people request. I also love the last song from Wicked, For Good, because it really is, because I knew you, I have been changed for good. And every patient I take care of has changed me. Their story has impacted me. Every day that I go to work and take care of someone, it's part of my focus group. It's reminding me how much more work we have to do and how we have to make it better, because our treatments have a long way to go and people want better options. And that's part of how I keep my drive to make things better.
Wonderful. Well, I'd like to thank Dr. Laura Esserman for her comments. Also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening over the radio or to the podcast. I'm Mark Zitter, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.